Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 221, featuring Afonso Salcedo, who I have known through my treks over to THU, which is a conference that I talk about probably too much, but I love it. And I meet also any great people there, like Afonso. And Afonso is actually, until very recently, was living in San Francisco. But he has worked in the visual effects and feature animation world for a long time. He was over at Framestore for a little bit in the UK, and then he moved to San Francisco and ended up getting a job at Pixar, did some lighting on the, in the animation, in the feature animation world. And he also did some stuff over at DreamWorks. And now he's actually in Los Angeles, and he is working for Disney Feature Animation for the next 5 months or so, which is pretty cool. But he's also done a bunch of live action shoots, and he's worked for the company called Masterclass, which you guys may have seen on social media. They advertise some really big celebrities that teach you masterclasses on things like, you mentioned Natalie Portman. He did a show with Natalie Portman teaching people about acting. So really fascinating guy, and got involved in a lot of things. He's also just an absolutely one of the nicest people I know. You, and I'm sure you can tell from just listening to him on a podcast what a kind person he is. So great to have him on, and I really appreciate him coming here and taking the time to talk to us only just a few days after he moved here from San Francisco. So it was really great to have him on. In terms of announcements, I got a couple of here. Let me go to my calendar to check it out. We have, of course, as you know, FMX is coming up. And FMX is going to be happening April 30th to May something. But on May 1st, there will be our V-Ray days, where we're going to have a series of talks. And we've got four talks scheduled for that day. So go to chaosgroup.com/FMX2019 to find out all of the details there. And make sure you register, because we'd love to see you there. I unfortunately will not be able to make it to FMX this year, but there will be some great people from Chaos Group that will be there. So go check it out. However, I will be at Total Chaos, and that is happening May 16th, 17th, and 18th. 16th is the master classes, and the 17th and 18th is the talks, and it's happening in Sofia, Bulgaria. There's all of us are going to be there, so it's going to be very exciting. So I can't wait to get to see you guys there, to come to Total Chaos, and I'm actually not even sure if there's any tickets left, so you may want to check. If you've been thinking about going, please check and make sure there's tickets available, because I don't even know if there's tickets available right now. It was pretty close to sold out not long ago, so good to know about that. The only other announcement I have is we have an update that we've done to the V-Ray benchmark. And if you guys are interested in V-Ray benchmark, it is 100% free, and it's available right from our website. So just go to the products section under Chaos Group and click on V-Ray benchmark, and you can go ahead and download it there. And you can also see the results of other people who have used V-Ray benchmark and see how your hardware lines up with what other people's hardware is, and see if you're working it on all four cylinders, or 16 cylinders, or 3,000 cylinders, depending on how many cores you have. Anyway, hopefully you guys are will be able to check that out. We would love to hear from you what you guys think, and let us know. All right. That being said, please enjoy this fantastic podcast with Afonso.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
You just moved to LA 5 days ago?
Yeah.
Wait, from Monday. Today's Thursday.
So I drove down. I drove down to LA on Saturday,
okay,
and my movers arrived on Monday. So officially, I would say Monday, April Fool's.
Yeah, you're not really here until your bed is here.
So I started at my LA life in April Fool's Day, which is actually pretty perfect. You know, I think that was the best way to start.
Right.
Yeah.
But okay, so there is, I mean, you've been around, you've done a lot of things. This is another big move in your life, right?
Yeah.
And you've done it a few times, but let's start with some of the early days. Like how did you start in this industry, right?
So I was actually, so I grew up in Portugal, even though I was born in the US.
Okay.
And I, when I was, you know, 17, 18, I already knew deep down that I always loved photography and film.
Right.
But in my head, I think growing up in a country like Portugal at the time, where there's actually not a lot happening culturally, you know, when I was a kid there.
Okay.
In my head, the only way that I could actually have a career would be to study something more meaningful, let's say like a tech job, right? Like studying computer science.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my goal. I was like, I love computers as well, you know, so I'm going to study computer science. And I moved to the UK to study computer science. So that's what I did. And this, you know, I ended up doing my undergrad in London and finishing my master's in London. And as soon as I finished my master's, I was like, what am I doing? I really want to work in film. You know, I really want to do photography. I really want to create visual stories, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as that happened.
Why do you think, you know, like there are several people like you and I, right? And I just want to get mm-hmm. that are. They happen to be good at math and computer science or whatever, but also very creative.
Yeah.
And we feel this obligation that to be responsible, we have to pursue that education in math and computer science and not because the art and creative is an irresponsible choice.
And I think that's, I think anyone who's a creative deep down, you know, always goes through that, right? Because,
right.
you know, not only there's a stigma in most societies about living a life as an artist, you know, mm-hmm. there is. It's just part of the nature of it. But there's also this thought that you're like, okay, I ended up like living in the UK, which at the time London was the most expensive city in the world next to Tokyo, you know.
Right.
And, you know, being in an environment like that where I was like, how can I ever make money actually being an artist in this town? You know, I don't know. And, you know, studying computer science at the time where, you know, it was pre-iPhones, it was pre all this stuff, you know, that was just the big tech boom that was happening. You know, you're studying something that you feel like there's a wave happening, but you're not really sure where it's going to take you.
Sure.
And my hope is that somehow I would find a way of merging, you know, finding a way of merging those two things, of merging, you know, my admiration and love for computers and, you know, my actual passion for image.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, it ended up being, you know, true to nature. It's like any camera that you pick up now is a computer, basically.
Sure.
And, you know, any photography camera that you pick up is basically a computer, you know, and it ended up being actually really useful. And but at the time I had no idea, right?
Yeah.
And the only thing that I knew is that after I finished my computer science degree was that I did not want to program. I did not want to be a programmer or work in IT or any of that.
Sure.
You know. So I finished my master's in London. I was actually called for my first ever like proper job interview, you know, to sit down, and it was a huge consulting company in London, you know, and I was like, this is amazing. It's like everyone wants to work here, you know, mm-hmm. and the interview kept being delayed and delayed and delayed. And I was just sitting there in this waiting room and looking around me, and the whole design of this space, I'll never forget it. The whole design of the office building was inspired by 2001, A Space Odyssey. So it was very minimal, very, you know, white.
Did they have the big red chairs?
Elements of red chairs. Yeah. And I was looking around and I was just, It triggered something in me, you know, and it triggered something that I was like, what am I doing? This is my real passion, you know. It's like being fascinated of how to tell a story visually, you know, why are those red chairs so significant, you know, and this visual that's happening in front of me. And the interview kept being delayed. And at a certain point, I just gave it all up. I got up and I was like, I'm sorry, I don't want to go through this interview. And I never actually had the interview, and I left, and I was like, I remember calling my parents and being like,
I walked out on an interview.
I walked out on my first interview and I want to work in film. And wow. That's what totally changed. And that was my big first decision, you know, of being
right.
Okay, let's see where this film adventure is going to take me.
Sure. Wow. Well, okay. So, but you did, you stayed in London.
Yeah.
And you ended up getting a job in film.
Yeah.
Which was
the first film was Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban.
Which is ridiculous. That's a dream job for most people. But actually, you know what I think is interesting about that is that I don't think that people really knew that. They knew Harry Potter, obviously, and this is the mm-hmm. third one. But that one is by far, to me, the best one.
It was. Thank you. I'm obviously slightly biased.
Sure.
But, you know, it was, you know, and obviously in that film, it was my first job in the industry. So I was actually working night shifts, you know. And
how did that happen? So how do you go from like consulting firm interview to like working at Framestore? Because like, I'm just going to work in movies. And then you just don't work in movies. Like,
yeah. So
there must have been some time that passed.
No, there was maybe like 6 to 8 months, I think.
Okay.
And what happened was that one, I was like, I need to figure out how to quick learn anything I can about, sorry about that. My phone was making interference.
It's okay.
So I need to figure out how to learn as quickly as possible what I need to do to actually have some kind of portfolio or reel that I can apply to these film studios or,
sure.
you know, visual effects houses in London. And as soon as I finished my master's, I started like, you know, and I skipped that interview. I was like, what is out there, you know? And at the time there was Bournemouth University,
right,
which was doing like a big, you know, the standard route for all the TDs and all the artists mm-hmm. working in the industry came from Bournemouth at the time. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't have time to go back to school. I need to figure out something quick. And mm-hmm. at the time, a new visual effects school was starting to come up, which was the Escape Studios, which still exists to this day.
Yeah.
So I was one of the first students at Escape Studios.
Anita is part of that, right?
Yeah, Anita is part of it. And I was there on super intensive, maybe a three-month program at the time where they basically kicked out like, this is what you need to learn about Maya, this is what you need to learn about Shake, and go, you know?
Right.
So I did those 3 months and I, at home, I was like doing a lot of like stuff on my own. Mm-hmm. At the time, there was not a lot of like worldwide web knowledge, you know, sharing kind of thing. It was very different. And, you know, I managed to be able to, in 6 months alone or 8 months max, I was able to produce like the crappiest like little reel that you can possibly imagine. And I think it was part of being in the right place at the right time. Framestore was desperate for people to join in to help the rendering team, you know, to figure out all the stuff that you usually start with.
Sure.
And they gave me a full-time position, not even an intern, not even a runner position. Like it was immediate, like you're part of the rendering team. You're going to help us fix all our renders, you know, and
yeah, there's probably a shitload of work.
Yeah. So I, you know, started a Harry Potter 3 working. I would go in at 8 p.m. and I would leave at 8 in the morning every day.
Wow.
So I had a crazy life in London, you know, mm-hmm. being at the studio by myself. No one else was there. So it was me and the security guard, you know, at Framestore. Right. And they had like two or three buildings at the time spread out near, kind of like a few blocks away in Soho. Mm-hmm. And I was fixing renders, right? So I would spend the whole night opening up what compositors were doing during the day, opening up all these Houdini files, opening up Maya files, and just learning on the job. Like, okay, this is airing out. Like, what's happened? What were they doing? How can I fix it? And I learned so fast in that turnaround, you know? And it took maybe, I was in that film for, again, maybe like 8 months, you know, or mm-hmm. 6 months. And I learned so much, and that was the only night shift I did. And immediately after Harry Potter, they put me working on Troy, and I already had a day shift. And it just went on pretty quickly, you know.
Wow.
Which was a trippy experience.
That's amazing. That's amazing. But you mentioned that you had you kind of longed to try to get to San Francisco at that point, at mm-hmm. some point. So what, how did that sort of materialize?
I think there was part of me, since I was born in San Francisco, but never had actually lived there at all in my life, you know, besides...
Well, you were three.
I was three. Right. So I didn't remember anything, right? And, you know, obviously it doesn't count, but there was, I think there was part of me that I was like, I feel like on a human level, I have to experience living where I was born, you know, just out of curiosity, you know, just total human feeling, you know, like there was like some kind of a nostalgia happening inside of me.
Well, if you're born in San Francisco, that makes sense.
I guess. And, you know, having been in Europe most of my life, I obviously romanticized that idea of like, okay, let's try it out, you know, and.
Well, it's the most European American city we have.
That's what I hear. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty European. It's not quite there.
No, it's not. It's still American.
But it's
but it's more European than Detroit
for sure,
or Memphis.
I was in London for at the end. I was there for 7 years, and one day I had just finished working on Troy, the film Troy with Brad Pitt.
Yeah,
and things were a little bit quiet, and I literally woke up one day and I was like, that's it. I'm going to San Francisco. I'm going to quit my job. I'm going to sell everything that I have and pack my bags and go. Right. And I did that. I walked into Frame Store and I quit my job. I'll never forget the interview because I had an exit interview with HR, you know, human resources. And they were like, but did you get a job? You know, and I'm like, nope. I have no idea what I'm going to do when I get there, you know?
Right.
We'll see. And I made that decision. I spent 1 month getting rid of everything I had in London, and I packed two bags and I flew to San Francisco.
Wow.
And yeah, a whole new chapter started then.
So that's your second big move.
That's right? My second big move. Yeah.
So then you moved to San Francisco with no job prospect, just the idea that whatever happens, it needs to happen in San Francisco, right?
And opening myself to that possibility, right? To be like, okay, maybe this is going to be the craziest decision I've ever had, and maybe I'm going to totally regret it after a few months, but I know that I need to try it, you know?
Right.
And I think ever since I can remember, it's always been part of my personality to be like, you know, I don't know if I'm going to die tomorrow, run by a truck. I have no idea, you know?
Sure.
And when you live with that sense that you can disappear from this, you know, universe, like at any moment, you're making certain decisions that might not seem totally rational to a lot of people, you know, but for me, it's like, okay, maybe there's something out there, and I will, you know, if, you know, I might regret it if I actually do not take that initiative and do not try it. And I knew that I just had to, and it made no sense at the time, and it's still looking back, I'm like, okay, totally rationally, on a rational level, it didn't make any sense, but it was amazing. And as soon as I landed in San Francisco, I was just the excitement of being surrounded by everything new, just the excitement of being surrounded by the unknown and meeting new people. And at the time, San Francisco, we talked about this at lunch, but San Francisco is a very artistic, bohemian, adventurous town, you know, and so it was very exciting to be there, you know, and coming from London at the time, San Francisco was actually way cheaper than London, and now it's totally the opposite, but when I was in San Francisco, when I landed in San Francisco, my rent was slashed in half, and my life quality went through the roof because of
that. So what year is this about?
This was 2004. I was 24 years old at the time.
Yeah, I can see that. And also San Francisco then was not what it is now.
Yeah.
In a sense of like, I mean, and we've talked about this too, but like nowadays San Francisco is ravaged by the tech industry.
Right? Yeah.
Like series like Silicon Valley is way more real than people think it is. But San Francisco was basically like now is completely consumed by the tech industry.
Yeah.
Right. And so while that sounds somewhat interesting and innovative, it's not the creative, artistic side that it used to be, right?
Yeah, it's very different, you know. And I think at the time that I went to San Francisco was soon after the first .com crashed, you know, the first .com boom crashed.
Yeah.
So it was even more of that sense of, okay, we tried the tech thing. It didn't really work out that well, you know, and there was still a lot of, you know, a lot of these tech companies went bust and a lot of people left. And what was left was like the artists and the creatives and the weirdos, you know, that were just like hanging out at coffee shops and like coming up with weird things to do.
Right.
And that's when I landed in San Francisco and I loved that experience. Right. But now it's, you know, there's a huge tech boom happening and it's totally shifted mentality of, and the energy of the whole city. And, you know, as a city is, and it's natural. I don't, you know, I don't blame it on San Francisco or anything else, but I, you know, a city is like a living organism, right? And it, you know, it comes and goes and it grows in different ways. And sometimes you as a human are growing in a different path than the city is growing into becoming. And you need to be aware of like, okay, let's not stay grounded just because you're nostalgically like linked to this romanticized view of the past, you know? It's like, okay, maybe it's okay. You had an amazing chapter and maybe it's time to move on. Right. So that happens in, that could happen anywhere, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it could. I think that's fair. I, you know, there's a lot of, you know, joking around that like that whole, the whole Silicon Valley area is just ravaged by venture capitalists wearing Patagonia vests, you know?
And it's true, you know?
It's not untrue, right? They're all driving Teslas and they're like, But at the same time, I think that there's some interesting things coming out of those things, but it's a little, the problem I have a little bit about it is that all those companies seem to be less about like, we're going to create something that's really cool. It's more like, we're going to create something that Facebook wants to buy.
Yeah. I think a lot of, becomes
really disturbing.
From my experience, I got to work in a few, closely with some tech companies in the Valley and all that stuff. And there is a sense of that, of like, okay, we're one day we're going to sell to this company and so on. So, you know, and a lot of decisions end up happening more towards that sense of how valuable can we become in terms of sale, rather than does this decision actually match the vision of the company and our mission as, you know, humans guiding this company forward. And to me, that's a big problem. You know, it's like, okay, I, being an artist, I think you tend to be more, you know, of maybe like a little bit aware of like the actual mission of things, because you tend to make decisions that are more, you know, you really care about and you're really like emotionally vested in. And, you know, it's problematic when you try, you know, there's a lot of creativity in tech. Don't get me wrong. You know, there's a lot of creativity happening, but it's a different type of creativity, right? And I think a lot of tech companies in Silicon Valley, they don't fully understand even how to gain value from hiring artists or creatives, you know, in terms of like just the storytelling alone of how they can actually tell better stories about who they are as a brand or as a business or what their mission might be, you know, and it becomes really frustrating as an artist trying to survive in that world, you know, trying to compete with people, you know, like doing their IPOs and making millions of bucks, you know, and so it slowly became like a pretty frustrating experience, you know.
I bet. Well, before any of that happened, let's go back there. So you moved there, you didn't have a job, you had just two suitcases, and then you hung out for a while and you said, well, better start looking for some work or see what kind of work's available around here.
Yeah.
And you had 7 years of experience at Framestore.
At Framestore, I only had 1 year of experience.
Oh.
So because I was in London for 7 years, in the UK for seven years. And I, you know.
Oh, right. Because you went to school.
I did my undergrad. I did my master's. Yeah. So, and then I worked at Framestore exactly 1 year.
Okay.
And so I had that experience. And in 1 year, I worked on three films at Framestore, which were Harry Potter 3, Troy, and Thunderbirds, which nobody has seen.
Oh, I've
outside
seen.
Of the UK. You haven't. Sorry. And landing in San Francisco, you know, at first I was like, okay, I'm not really sure what to do here. And maybe I can study something related to art. So I started at different master programs, studying at the Academy of Art, doing visual effects. A master's in fine art and visual effects. Mm-hmm. And because my feeling was like, okay, maybe I should really invest in the art side of things, you know? Sure. So I started doing that, and, you know, it was like a weird thing of 2 months into that program. I was like, wait, I'm really not learning anything, because I already have 1 year of experience at Framestore, you know, one of the world's leading visual effects houses at the time. And so I quickly was like, I need to find something to do. I don't think I need to spend 3 years doing another master's, you know?
Right.
So at the time, I saw a job posting for that Pixar was hiring, opening up an internship program. Okay. And since I was at school, oddly enough, even though I had industry experience before, I actually could apply as an intern to Pixar.
Oh, right.
And I thought, nice, maybe that's a good way to get in, you know? And obviously at the time I already had this dream of someday, maybe I'll work at Pixar, you know, but it was a very kind of like a long-term goal, you know, mm-hmm. of like a long-term dream. And mm-hmm. I never thought it would be possible. And, you know, I had only a phone interview with Pixar, and they gave me the internship position, which was a 6-month opportunity to work at Pixar on Cars as part of their rendering department as well. And because I had, you know, I was considered the student because I was at the Academy of Art, but I also had the film industry experience. I think it put me as at an advantage compared to everybody else. But
you were a student only in name.
Yeah, I know. It was a weird thing. And I still remember after that 6 month.
But that's a good way to get in. It was like probably a good time.
Yeah. And it, you know, they had hundreds of applicants, and, you know, they chose, I think in my internship program, it was maybe 13 of us or something. I don't remember correctly, but I was around then. And, you know, all of us worked straight into crunch time to work on Cars and help with the rendering department. And, you know, all of a sudden you're working with people who've been there for, you know, since the early days of Pixar, and mm-hmm. getting really close to them. And, you know, I already had compositing experience. So I was bringing a lot of that knowledge that I had, you know, like to help solidify some pipeline issues.
Yeah, because they didn't really do much.
No, at all. And, you know, it ended up being an amazing experience. And after 6 months, that's when I went through a whole different round of interviews internally at Pixar, where for 1 and 2 days, I was like interviewing with a lot of department heads, you know, across multiple disciplines. And they were, you know, you really had to like hone in on like, okay, this is what I did as an intern. This is what I can bring to the table. And mm-hmm. this is what I really want to do. And after that interview process, they gave me a full-time position, and I ended up staying there for 7 years.
Yeah, 7 years. That's a good stay.
Yeah, it was a pretty amazing experience. They're like, I call them my Pixar family, because some of my best friends are still from there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny because you and I mentioned like an old friend of mine from DD who's a Pixar, and was like, oh my God, you know Estrus, right? So yeah, it's a great place and a really, really interesting. So what were some of the big projects that you worked on while you were there? And what was your main responsibility? The lighting, so, it sounds like lighting.
Yeah. So that's the thing. It was very interesting because when I finished I always knew that, you know, my passion has always been photography and cinematography. That's kind of like what I love the most. And if I was going to stay at Pixar, I wanted to be in lighting. Because that's really what kind of like has more to do with that cinematography, photography mm-hmm. side of things. And I remember doing the full-time interview that I was telling you about. And mm-hmm. I remember sitting there and, you know, some head of department like got up and he was like, wait, but what if I told you that the only way you could stay at Pixar was if you worked with me on tools, you know? And I was like, then I don't want to be here, you know? Mm-hmm. And he got up and left. And I was like, oh my God, maybe I totally said that the wrong way, you know? And I was totally paranoid about it. But I think it's important. It was a valuable lesson to be like, you know,
be true to yourself.
Be true to yourself and stick to your guns. And, you know, I really knew that I wanted to work in lighting. And I told that to multiple people. And they were like, okay, we're going to start working on this movie called Ratatouille. Mm-hmm. So we'll give you a chance. And the chance that they gave me was that at the time there was a 3-week program to train new lighters to join Ratatouille. And Ratatouille was being, the director of photography of Ratatouille was Sharon Callahan, which has been at Pixar for, you know, the longest time. And she's one of the most genius, most incredible, most artistic director of photography in animation. And okay. I think she's actually the only female cinematographer that works in animation as part of the AAC.
Oh, wow.
Which is the American Society of Cinematographers. And so it was a really big deal to work on Ratatouille, or to have a chance to work on Ratatouille. When they gave me, it was like, okay, there's 3 weeks of a program. You can start that program to train with other experienced lighters.
Sure.
And at the end of each week, we're going to tell you if you can move on to the next week or not.
Right.
So I did the first week, and they were like, okay, you can come back on Monday, and did the second week. I did the second week, and they were like, okay, you can come back on the third week. Okay. And after the third week, they were like, you're going to be a lighter on Ratatouille.
Wow.
And they gave me the opportunity, and I was, all of a sudden, I was full-time artist at Pixar working in lighting with one of the most amazing director of photography in the industry. And
but the lighting teams at Pixar are not that big. Right?
Like, no, it depends on the project.
So like Ratatouille, how many?
Ratatouille was maybe 32, 33 people at its peak. It's
bigger than I thought.
Yeah. And it's not, you know, Cars 2 at the end, we must have been 60 something or 70, almost double.
Right.
So it really depends on the project, you know?
Sure.
And interestingly enough, I think, I mean, obviously Ratatouille, Pixar was still pretty small back then compared to what it is now, you know? Right. In terms of the number of employees, we were not even part of Disney. So it was a little bit of a different experience, but it was, I've never felt happiest, you know. It was just like such an amazing opportunity to be able to join the team and work with these artists in a movie that, to me, even to this day, I look at it and I'm like, it's holding up so well, you know, the painterly quality of the images and just how cautiously perfect everything is, you know, so how organic everything is.
It had a very unique look to
it. Yeah.
That was felt very French,
you know. Yeah.
in a very interesting way. It had almost a painterly look to it that was not dissimilar emotionally speaking, not the same, but emotionally speaking, I felt the same as The Triplets of Belleville,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I love that film.
Yeah, so it was really a great film. And I love the fact that they sort of, you know, Pixar every now and then, that they'll break away from the look and make it different. You know, like Up was very different than things I've seen before. Brave was another one, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really kind of cool to see that kind of work. And I think it probably was a really great experience to do that. But you mentioned that your passion, like, you worked in CG, but your passion was really about the camera, right? Which, by the way, being a lighter makes complete sense, because that's about as close to the camera as you get in CG, right?
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. It's like, you know, camera and light go hand in hand together, and it's very hard to differentiate both, right? And at Pixar, the camera department is actually the layout department, and it happens separately than the lighting department.
Sort of sense, yeah.
Which, you know, different studios have different ways of working through that. When I worked at DreamWorks, it was the lighters would actually do some camera movement as well.
Oh, interesting.
So it's an interesting thing, but it's, you know, I think coming from, like, having spent my whole life, you know, holding film, video cameras and photography cameras, I always had, I guess my passion is like to create the visual frame, you know, that you see on screen, you know, and at Pixar, that was, you know, the closest I could get to that was being in the lighting department. But it's something that I feel like it's a common thread throughout everything that I do, you know.
Okay.
And different studios or different companies will have, you know, different roles that kind of like attune to that a little bit better.
Right.
So, but yeah, my Pixar experience, I mean, from that first lighting experience at Ratatouille to the last one that I did, which was Cars 2, I think, you know,
it was
an unbelievable learning process, you know, where you're picking up elements from painting, from photography, from cinematography, from lighting, from compositing, from visual effects, you know, you're kind of like bringing everything together in one one single lot, you know, goal, you know, to sure. create the visual story. And I love that. I'm obsessed with that, actually.
Well, it's cool, but you eventually sort of started your own idea yeah. of doing that. So how did that come about, and how do you sort of start your own company on doing that kind of work?
Well, it was so when I, you know, I was finishing Cars 2, and I was already getting some job offers from other companies, you mm-hmm. know, like even in Weta and all that stuff. But mm-hmm. I wanted to stay in the U.S. and DreamWorks gave me an offer to join their lighting team as well.
Okay.
And at the time I was like, okay, you always learn something by joining a different studio because mm-hmm. people are working different ways, using different software. And, you know, there's always an excitement to that. And I joined DreamWorks PDI at the time, which mm-hmm. doesn't exist anymore. But at the time they had an office in Redwood City. Yep. And I joined that doing lighting and compositing as well, and a more senior position, you know, so I had a team with me and all that stuff. So it was a very humbling experience to actually start over in a new studio.
Right.
And it was an amazing experience, but I was there for maybe, I worked on two films. And after that, I felt like it was time to just venture on my own. And part of the reason was also because there was really not a lot left in San Francisco,
right?
You know, in terms of opportunities. And I'm like, I knew that if I quit my job at DreamWorks, that basically the best solution for me would be to venture out on my own and try to freelance and try to figure out what other creative opportunities I could create.
Got it.
And it was part of the nature of like just the changing scene of the city, you know, that I was living in. And possibly if there were more studio work that I might have taken that instead, you know. But yeah, again, quitting DreamWorks was a very similar thing where I remember
similar
talking
to
London.
Friend. Yeah.
Where, you know, I was quitting. They were like, what are you going to do? And I'm like, I have no idea. I'm like, right. I'll try to figure it out, you know, right. I'll try to do something. And a week later, I was doing a live action commercial for a local bank, you know.
Okay.
And I'm filming that live action commercial for the local bank. And I'm getting a call from a producer in New York who's doing a documentary in San Francisco and asking me if I could film that bit, you know. And it was right. like 2 days of shooting, and it ended up being Adrian Grenier from HBO.
Oh, wow.
You know, he was at the time doing Entourage and all that stuff. And
right.
So all of a sudden I'm like working with this guy from HBO and Entourage, you know, doing this thing that actually never became a film at the end, you know, but it was still an experience, you know, and it was still an amazing experience for that. So I just kept going that path and right. seeing where it would take me.
I mean, but okay, so you've done this twice now, right? or maybe more, but at least twice from the stories you've said, where you basically said, I'll take the risk, whatever.
Yeah. And
a lot of people don't take that risk, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the risk is less than people think it is, and they just don't want to take it because there is an element of risk? Or do you think that you just got extraordinarily lucky and it's not normally the way that it goes?
That's a really good question. And I'm not really sure how to answer that.
Because I know there's obviously talent behind it. And even the most humble, like, people recognize that, well, my talent helped me get there, right? But there's also like, right place, right time, yeah. whatever it is. But like, you're like, maybe someday I could work for Pixar. It's like, nope, how about next month? You know, yeah. that happens right now. That happens because you're talented enough to, et cetera, but you happen to be there. I think people don't take enough risks, especially the creative ones, right?
Yeah. And I mean, in all honesty, it's probably one of the hardest things to do, right? Because right. one, it's not, you know, you get this opportunity. It's one in dozens of others that you get rejected for, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you definitely have to put yourself in a place where you're going to be rejected constantly by some company, you know? Like I've applied a million times to ILM. I never gotten a job at ILM,
right,
you know?
Okay.
And I've applied to so many other companies, you know, like I was telling you, like Apple and Google and right. all these other things. And, you know, for job descriptions that I look at it and I'm like, you know, obviously I'm not applying to things that I don't think that I would be able to do, but
sure.
I'm applying to things that I think I would be able to do and then get rejected, which is like almost even worse, you know, where right, okay. I have to put myself in a place where I'm okay with, you know, that feeling that it's not going to work out or I'm not going to get that opportunity. And it's not about me, you know, it's just a matter of circumstance, or it's maybe it's the matter that I even write my cover letter or the way I phrase my resume, whatever it is, it can be a million things. Right. But I guess what I do is that I'm never afraid of, you know, of being humbled by losing an opportunity or by not getting something, you know. I think the feeling of receiving a no is, to me, it's much better and healthier than the feeling of never having tried it.
Yes.
You know?
I think that's the thing that a lot of people they won't apply for a job at Pixar because they may get a no.
Yeah.
Right? And the no is too much for them to bear with.
Yeah.
Right? And thing is, you can still try later, you can do whatever, you know,
that
happens, right? So I think there's I'm just trying to get people to understand, like, it taking that risk and that chance is a big one, right?
Yeah.
So I'll give you another quick story, if that's okay for the listeners, because this has happened to me recently. So Blur is right around the corner here. I mentioned it earlier. And I go there all the time because I've got friends there. We work on projects there, and I know the Blur guys really well. So I go there and I, you know, ring the doorbell, and it's, you know, one of the little eyeball camera things. I was like, "Hey, Betty, it's Chris." And she's like, "Come on in, sweetheart," you know, and she comes in and she gives me a big hug. Right. So she's a receptionist there. Now, she's been there for like 20 plus years. Right. Mm-hmm. She's been there forever. But I remember very specifically when I first, you know, before I even got into the visual effects industry, I was like, I'm thinking about, you know, maybe I should apply for a job at Blur because their stuff was amazing. And at the time, they were the only studio that was doing ridiculously cool visual effects and animation using Max, which is what I knew, right? And I was like, I'm going to apply for a job at Blur. But I didn't know what to do. It's like, what do I need to get a job there? So I literally called Blur on the phone, and I got Betty, who worked there at the time, right? And she says, "All right, honey, you ain't going to get past this door unless you have a really good, you know, demo reel. You got to have this. You have to get your ducks in a row." And she basically outlined it for me in like 5 minutes. And I knew nothing. Like, I don't know. You know, it's like, I've got some renderings I've done in architecture. Maybe that's good enough. And like, nah, you know, you got to have this. You got to do that. And she basically told me, said this information. And she's the receptionist, but she's pretty much the gatekeeper of the company. And then I told her this story like a week or two ago. I said, "You know, by the way, I called you about 20 years ago and I asked you some advice and you told me this, and I didn't end up getting a job at Blur, but you gave me all the information I needed to get my shit in order." Right.
Yeah.
And she's really, and I said, "Yeah." It's like, and look where I am now. You know, I wouldn't have had that phone call with you 20 years ago, I wouldn't have known that. But that's the thing, right? I didn't get the job at Blur, but I got the advice I needed. So even if you fail, you still learn.
Yeah. Right? And to me, that's the most valuable aspect of it.
Right.
You know, it's like, okay, even if I fail at anything that I do, like, I always do postmortems on everything that I do almost, you know, and it's like any tiny little project that I do, I'm like, I do a meditation on it. And I'm like, okay, what went wrong? What could I do better? You know, what's the story there? What can I work on myself, you know, like to actually try to become a better employee, a better freelancer, a better contractor, whatever it is, you know, like what are the elements that I can make better next time? And I think part of the reason of trying these things, of applying to jobs, applying to projects, getting rejected, I mean, you know, being an artist, it's like you have to be comfortable with that. And I mean, or you have to learn how to be as much comfortable as you can, because you're never going to be fully comfortable. I mean, it's always like, it's not easy, right? It's always an exercise in calmness.
You're never going to settle for something that's a failure, right?
You know, it's hard. And it's hard to admit your own mistakes, and it's hard to admit your own like wrong decisions or whatever it is that you might do that could have been done better. And especially hard the more you are like furthering your career. And if you're managing people, you know, and your decisions actually affect other people's careers or something, or potentially could, then you have to be humbled enough to really learn from that and to really listen to what people are telling you and to really figure out, okay, how can I take this advice and this feedback and, yeah, you know, improve and grow from that. And that's really what I try to do with everything that I do. And, you know, so far, you know, it's turning out okay, I guess.
Yeah. So I just want to get back to it a little bit. Yeah. So we jump around a little bit, but the you went from being a, you know, a virtual DP and working in, you know, at Pixar and some great movies. What was it like to be in front of live action all of a sudden? And how did that compare?
It was, you know, in a lot of ways, it was basically the same thing. And in a lot of ways was like completely different. You know, the language is very different. You know, the tech, like, you know, lighting a live action shoot is very technical in a lot of ways.
Sure.
And technical in terms of like actual physical maneuver of lights and physics and all that stuff, you know, and electricity, you know. And, so there's all these components that you would never even think twice, you know, in CG. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, the eye, the way you see things around you, the way you think about how to light a scene or a room or an event or an action, whatever it is, you know, it's the same, you know, it's
sure.
If you're a painter, you're painting a single frame the same way a DP is going to start thinking of how to actually light a movie scene, you know?
Right.
And it's all kind of related. And that's the beauty of it. It's that artistic sensibility to how to create an emotion and how to tell a story, it doesn't really change much, you know?
Right.
And that's the beauty of it. But the problem is that when people like to label people, you know, and okay, when you're labeled as a CG lighter or a CG DP, mm-hmm, you're not really respected as a live action, you know, cinematographer or a live action DP.
Yeah.
You know, they're very different worlds, and obviously for the same reasons, you know, you have different teams working on different projects, and, you know, in a animation film, you're kind of like secluded to your own little office and you're doing your thing and you show them to the director. And in a live action, you have like, okay, maybe we're working with a union and we have like 100 people working on this, right, and we have to figure out not only the set design, but all this other stuff happening at the same time. And it's a different animal, you know, but it's kind of like a distant cousin, you know. But,
sure.
So you can learn, you know. I think the hardest thing in life is to really train your eye to see things a certain way.
Okay.
And if, you know, like, okay, maybe if I'm working on a live action shoot, the medium is going to be different and the brushes are going to be different, but I can still paint that story.
Right.
You know, so it's figuring out the different medium, but I love how similar they are, you know.
It's cool, but I think, you know, what's in, I think that people don't realize, especially, well, actually nowadays I think they do, right? With the renderers, the way they are now,
it's more physical.
It's way more physical based, yeah, right?
And all, so it's getting closer, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's lighting now is much more of a simulation of physical lighting,
right? Yeah,
so it's much closer. The only thing is that it's instantaneous.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting.
And that's the thing I love about live action is that it's so organic, and it's,
yeah,
you know, you're touching things and you see exactly what's happening and you're interacting with people in so many different ways.
But you do have other restrictions, like you can't put that light, yeah, anywhere you want to, right?
Yeah,
you know, so
unless you have the budget for it.
Right, right.
But yes, you're limited by physics of the, you, sure, know, the world that you're in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
you get creative in those. Like, you find technically creative solutions, mm-hmm, to those things, which is an awesome thing.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's like anything. It's like, okay, you know, working live action, you're always thinking about budgets. It's like, okay, this, you know, a client gives me this budget for a project, or, mm-hmm, it could be a corporate video or a little documentary. What kind of budget do I have? And it's never going to be enough budget. You know, it never is. Yeah. It's like, okay, with this budget, I can get this camera and maybe these lenses and maybe these lights and let's go for it, you know, but
get a knife,
you're always going to hit that budget. A always. Yeah, totally. And it, you know, it's, you know, and there's amazing films that are being filmed that like there's a few examples. I know Tangerine was, you know, filmed with an iPhone and it's pretty amazing what they did with it. And it you know, you can, that's the beauty of it right now. It's like, right. you can have access to, even with an iPhone, if you understand the, you know, how to tell a story with, you know, not only in editing, but how the camera is going to move and how you're going to frame some shots and yep. you're going to go pretty far. You know, there's really not a lot of excuses and you don't need the best camera. You don't need the best lights and just think about how to cheat, you know, as much as possible to create the story that you want to tell and create a bigger, better emotion, you know?
Yeah. I was joking with my dad can't take a good picture to save his life. So I always joke about it. It's like, I can give him a Leica. He's never going to take a good picture. You know what I mean? Just as the camera is not what actually makes the picture, it's the person behind the lens.
Right? I know. It's like, I mean, as you know,
composition in itself is like where you start and any camera is suitable for composition. You know?
Yeah. I mean, talk about an art form that has been devalued so much by the nature of how the world is changing. And one of them is photography, you know, and right.
Everyone has a camera in their pocket.
Everyone has a camera in their pocket. And, you know, I've done a lot of commercial and editorial photo shoots over the years. And it's, you know, I love it when people come to me and they're like, oh my God, you have an amazing camera. And I'm like, well, you know, like it's not really just the camera. It's like the person that's actually holding the camera.
No shit. Yeah.
But, you know, I'm bringing years of experience to this, you know.
Estrus, you and I were talking about this. He was telling me we were on Stealth and he was one of the leads on Stealth and stuff. And one of the people he was leading, she did, Lynn Bassus was her name, and she did an incredible shot on Stealth where the terrible film, but beautiful shot, where the plane was landing on an aircraft carrier. And it looked so real that there was actually, like, many years later when people even forgot the movie came out, there was some viral video that came out like, look at this crazy plane that the military is developing. It's like, no, that's from Stealth, right? But it looked perfect, right? Yeah. And they're like, wow, that is so well lit. That's amazing. What HDR did she use? And it's like, oh. No, it's not Lynn. It's the HDR. It's like, no.
You know, that happens in everything that you do and when you're creating images. And, you know, part of it is like, okay, it's beautiful that if people don't notice the amount of work that goes behind it, you know, but you also deserve, I mean, you would never go to Picasso and be like, wow, what amazing brush you use. Like, it's the best brush.
Where do you buy your paints?
You know what I mean? It's like, it's so fascinating to me. And it's always a struggle I think when you start dealing with commercial clients, part of the education is really that process of, you know, creating an understanding of the amount of work that actually goes behind. And
I think the thing that, especially on the production side of things, mm-hmm. if you're a producer or you own a studio or you do whatever, is they are trying to find a tangible thing that's like an IP that they own. Right.
Yeah.
And if it's someone's talent, that's much harder to own.
Yeah.
The only thing they can do is keep that person employed. Mm-hmm. But if it's technology that they developed, then they have IP, right?
Yeah.
And that's the thing. You know, like, for example, there was a lot, you know, I did a lot of stuff with digital human work, right? And they're like, we have all this technology to create digital humans. Like, if you lost three people that mm-hmm. are artists, you will suddenly realize how much that technology is actually worth, because most of what makes it look really good is those three people, not the technology.
Yeah.
So it's always a difficult thing.
Yeah.
But I do want, can we talk a little bit about Masterclass?
Of course. Yeah.
Okay. So let's get into that. So obviously you were doing that and then you got into Masterclass, right? So and this is the stuff that, I mean, everyone who's been on any kind of social media, they're bombarded by Masterclass videos, right?
They're really good at ads.
They're really good at ads, but they're also really appealing, right? Yeah. People are like, they've got some of the biggest names in the industry of each of their industries mm-hmm. to give you a Masterclass. So what is that all about?
So I, you know, Masterclass is a pretty special company in my heart because I feel like they're merging two things that I've always really loved in my career, which is education and filmmaking, you know, storytelling. And it's really rare that you see a company really bringing creating the best possible storytelling flow in terms of like the video content and filmmaking content that they're creating.
Right.
But also like actually providing an educational value that could be really inspiring for people.
Right.
And even when I was at Pixar, I was already like teaching part-time on, you know, different schools and universities and talking at conferences and all that stuff. So I, as much as possible, I was always trying to like find ways of like keep doing that, you know? Mm-hmm. And when I saw this opportunity of Masterclass, I felt like it would be like the best of both worlds. And so I was hired to join the team as a creative producer where it's...
Which is kind of a misleading name for us a little bit.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because typically in our industry, you hear a producer and you're like, okay, you're like budgeting and you're scheduling and you're doing all that stuff. And as a creative producer of Masterclass, you're actually almost like a creative director. So you're overseeing the creative of class production, right? So it's purely on the creative side. So you know, I would get ownership of, okay, maybe we're trying to pitch to this instructor about a potential class that we want to make. So I would write a treatment and I would write an initial idea of pitch for what the class topics should be. And have an initial meeting with that instructor and the instructor's team and try to get that approved. And if it gets approved, then potentially I would keep that class under my belt and I would take the whole class ownership from beginning to end.
Got it.
So I would do the pre-production on the class, the visual development for the class, working with a team of production designers, art directors, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Being on set to the actual duration of the film shoot, which typically was like 3 days, and then overseeing the whole creative direction for the post-production. So I would oversee the editorial, motion graphics, color grading, you know, whatever it might happen in post-production. Mm-hmm. So you would work a few months on each class. It's almost like a documentary film project, right?
Sure.
You're dealing with licensing, you know, when it comes to like film classes, you know, because you have to use a lot of B-roll from these film studios. So it's kind of like merging all these things that I feel my whole career I've been doing, you know, which is lighting, cinematography, like all these directing, production, like all these different technicals that I had throughout my career were all coming together in Masterclass. And it was, creatively speaking, it was an amazing experience. You know, I did a class with Natalie Portman, acting, and I was developing a few other classes. And it was tremendous, you know, it was a powerhouse of creativity, you know, and the team that they have is like, really, they're bringing in some of the best artistic talent, you know, in the industry, you know, in editing, and it's really amazing. And it felt like I was working with a junior, you know, like a very young Pixar or something. It could be something like that, you know.
But so it was an amazing experience. It's flabbergasting the talent that group has been able to bring to these courses, right? This isn't like lynda.com, right? This
is
like, you know, you're learning from Natalie Portman about acting, or you're learning from, you know, Steve Martin about, you know,
comedy. Right? Yeah, they have Jodie Foster teaching first time directing, you know, and it is mind-blowing, and it's pretty special because it creates, you know, they created a look that it's a very intimate, personal feeling that you're actually sitting there with the instructor, you know, in a tiny, you know, in a personal cozy home, you know, and you're hearing directly from them. And it, you know, they created this whole environment where students are sharing their learnings and, you know, sharing work that they create, you know, any leap of it's is teaching photography, you know, there's all these like things that create a pretty amazing exposure to and access to these instructors that are the best of the world, you know?
Right.
I think they have something special there, you know, it's a pretty unique company and there's nothing else quite like that.
Yeah.
I don't think.
I mean, they must have a lot of investment to be able to get that level of talent and all that stuff to them, which is really amazing. But I also think that there's just the idea of someone, you know, feeling they have access, you know, to some extent,
yeah,
to the knowledge that they get out of. They feel like, you know, if I'm going to learn about comedy from Steve Martin, I'm going to learn about it more than his 2-minute interview on the Jay Leno show.
Yeah, you know, exactly. I mean? It goes, so, yeah, it goes pretty in depth. And, you know, as a creative producer working on a class, you know, like trying to come up with a class idea that is only, you know, it's going to be not only entertaining for students to be able to stay 3, 4, or 5 hours, you know, at home, sure, watching it, but it also has to actually give some value where you actually feel like you're growing something in your own, yep, artistic or creative path or whatever. You know, they have classes in poker now, and they have classes in,
wow,
all these, you know, in science, there's an astronaut class, you know, wow, so it can really be anything. And the most important thing is feeling, okay, are we actually creating educational content, you know, for people? And,
right,
and it's, you know, it has to be mixed with, okay, we're creating a high end budget, you know, like a beautiful filmmaking, like, course, you know,
sure,
it's like, how do we create a story that flows? How can we use motion graphics in a smart way that it's actually going to keep, like, you know, provide better information about certain topics? There's so many different variables that go into it, you know, right, and it's a phenomenal experience. I mean, I really think they have something really special. And the head of creative and masterclass is this amazing producer from here in LA, Rebecca Yeldam. And I think she worked on Motorcycle Diaries and all these other films. Okay. So she's super experienced in the industry, and she has a lot of connections, and she brings, I love that she works as head of creative, because she brings her experience in, like, not only storytelling, but a vision, you know, her vision in creative filmmaking of how to better frame certain things in education and how to better frame certain things in online video, you know, to actually create amazing content that could easily be, I don't know, a TV show, you know,
like, right.
It's amazing. I learned so much, you know, in that experience there. And I feel really lucky to have had that.
That's amazing. That's great. But you had, you know, going back to what we talked about, you know, earlier, obviously you felt that San Francisco had changed with the tech industry, mm-hmm, et cetera. And so you felt the urge to move to LA. Like, so what was calling you in LA that brought you here?
I started thinking of LA.
You've been talking about this
for a long time.
Long time, yeah. I remember, yeah.
I remember I started to really deeply think about LA maybe 3 years ago.
Okay.
So it's been a long-term decision.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, obviously being, I think two things happen. One, once the older you get, the harder it is to make these decisions of relocating somewhere else.
Yep.
You know, that's just a fact. Mm-hmm. And I've also been in San Francisco for 15 years. Mm-hmm. So it only makes it even harder, right? Because sure, you have
your roots are set.
Yeah, you have your roots, you have your home. And, you know, I had what we call it, the golden handcuffs, which is having an apartment that's rent controlled in San Francisco.
Yeah.
You know, in an environment
you're not moving back.
You're never, yep, going to find an apartment like that. And, yep, you know, all these variables, like, make it super hard and very emotional. And, you know, it was really hard to make the jump. And I knew that I was not going to be able to afford to actually do the relocation by myself, you know, mm-hmm, to LA, just because of the nature of things. Mm-hmm. And either I would have to do something like London, where I actually sold everything that I had and just, like, yep, shipped with two bags to San Francisco, you know, mm-hmm, to LA, or, you know, I would have to find an opportunity that it would actually bring me down here. And right, Disney gave me a contract to work on Frozen 2 for 5 months.
Right.
And nice, they were kind enough to help with relocation as well.
Awesome.
And I could not say no to that. You know, I've been feeling for a long time that I had to be surrounded by people that are trying to create things. And yeah, there's a wave of creativity happening in LA right now that it's so exciting. One of the most exciting in the US, at least.
Yeah.
And it's something that I have to be surrounded by. You know, I have to find collaborative partners to do photography or even go on hikes or go grab a drink or whatever it is. You know, I want to be surrounded by people that are creating things, that are playing violin, that are like singing, that are painting, that are writing, you know, whatever it is. It's kind of like what fuels your imagination and what fuels your drive.
The resurgence in LA in terms of the creative stuff is huge right now. Mm-hmm. And it's, a lot of it is obviously due to the streaming content.
Yeah.
And I never, when the streaming was happening, I was like, somehow they picked LA again, you know, because I guess there was a base here that's strong enough to warrant
to appeal.
But I think it's great. And I think that, it draws people, talented people like you to like, all right, this is where if I want to continue to do these kind of things, LA is
it's where I want to be. Yeah. And it feels right. You know, it's obviously it's been, I haven't slept well in like 2 months maybe because as soon as I started thinking about this potential decision, you know, it's been quite a whirlwind of emotional roller coaster. But I could not be more excited. And now that I'm here, now that I finished unboxing my things, you know, I'm like, this is exactly where I need to be, you know?
Right. Well, and you only finished unboxing a couple days ago, so you still have a, you still have a few days to get used to it.
Yeah, I'm
But you found your local Trader Joe's and your,
You know, it's, I'm in a artistic, like little, you know, my whole building is like maybe 8 units and everyone is a creative, everyone is an artist. And, and it's, you know, everyone I'm meeting in every corner of LA is an artist, you know, and they're creating something or they're helping artists be artists, you know? And to me, that's so refreshing. It's
you're not meeting car dealers or, or stockbrokers.
And even if you are, maybe there are car dealers on one end and they're like writing a movie at night, you know?
Or in a band or something.
And to me, that makes you feel so alive, you know? Yeah. And that's kind of like, you know, maybe this is part of my midlife crisis. I don't know. I'm 40 years old now, so maybe it is. But I'm excited to really explore, you know, to just feel like everything's new again.
I think, well, first of all, again, you know, really great that Disney is involved and got out here to work on probably another really great film, you know, and Disney's doing great content these days. So that's really cool. And it's, I'm really glad that they were able to get you here because the fact is that you've been wanting to come here and you've been trying to figure it out for a long time. And this is, sometimes you have to wait a couple of years, right? Before the opportunity presents itself. And that's good.
I think patience is one of my biggest virtues, you know?
And really?
Yeah. I've been doing meditation for 22 years now. And it's, you kind of learn how to calm yourself down when, you know, even when the world seems to be ending. And, and you know, I think if I didn't have that, if I didn't have that inner calmness, you know, to help me guide certain decisions, I would, I would not be where I'm at right now, you know, and it also allows me, you know, like backtracking a little bit to that whole conversation we had about not being afraid to like, just go for it and take risks and ask for things, you know, and hearing a lot of no's, you know, like, it helps you deal with that, you know? It helps you being like, okay, I get it. It's not the right time or I'm not the right person for this. It's not a personal thing, you know? It's let me know what I can improve on. Let me know what you're looking for, you know? And maybe this is something that I actually want to work on and become better at, you know? And I mean, I was telling you at lunch about that pitch that I had at Apple a year ago.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a similar experience where I was just like working with some friends of mine and we were talking about a documentary series about the World Cup. And I was like, well, maybe I should pitch this to some companies. I had no idea. I was living in San Francisco still a year ago. And I was like, I had no idea where to start. So I found Tim Cook's email online, you know, which is public. It's not a big search or
probably
anything.
Probably tim@apple.com.
Yeah, exactly. Something like that. And I was like, well, I'm going to send him an email. And I sent him an email.
Right.
And a day later, his assistant connected me with the three executives from Sony that are, you know, managing the original content team at Apple.
Right.
And they scheduled a pitch meeting in LA to go talk to them in person about the idea that I had. And I was like, that's from sending an email to Apple randomly to Tim, you know? And so, you know, anything's possible. It's like a fresh reminder.
Here's another example, right? So like one of the people I've always wanted to have on the podcast is John Carmack, right? Because he's a brilliant technical mind, like amazing, like a pioneer in the world of computer graphics and games and that stuff. Well, you know what I did is I DM'd him on Twitter, right? And he responded.
Yeah.
And he's like, that sounds interesting. And he goes, Joe Rogan's been trying to have me on his podcast for years, but the company's a little bit wishy-washy about me going live on podcast. And it's like, and especially after Elon's appearance on Joe Rogan. And I said, well, first of all, I was like, I would never release a podcast without you or your PR department authorizing it. And he goes, well, I really appreciate it, but I, you know, just to be safe, I'm going to have to pass. But I had a conversation with John Carmack, right?
Yeah. And he plants the seed and it opens the door.
And then maybe down the line, he goes, you know, that guy, his podcast is pretty popular. Maybe I should go on that. And,
you never know. Yeah. I mean, it's a small industry. It's a small world.
Always going to try.
You're always going to connect the dots eventually, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, it's what was the dad in Back to the Future? It's like, I'm just afraid of rejection. It's like, don't be afraid of rejection. Rejection is like the best thing you can learn from, you know?
It's so true. Yeah. And you, I think you grow to love rejection after a while, you know, and ideally you try to. And I've
certainly done that. You win the first time, it's never going to get better.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, it's just part of the nature. And, you know, but there's still things that I'm like deeply afraid of and that I totally admit. Like, for example, I've been doing photography for a lot of years and I've never had an exhibition of my work, you know?
Right.
And I'm an introvert and I'm scared so much of like just being out in public with my work.
But your stuff is, I mean, your cinematography is out there publicly.
But it feels different. Okay. It feels less naked because it's more invisible, you know, in terms of...
And it's paid work by commission.
Yeah, you're like, okay, it's the film studio. No one is going to stand, you know, watching the credits roll by and be like, that's Afonso. You know, like nobody does that.
Right.
Unless you work in the industry.
Right, sure.
But...
well, you'll notice in LA, people stay throughout
the credits. Yeah.
It's the only city.
I'm okay with that. Yeah. But yeah, photography, for example, it's one of those things that it's, you know, this year is the first year where I was like actually set out like a mind goal of being like, no, I need to be more naked about it. You know, I need to allow myself to be more vulnerable about it and really display and showcase my work a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And it's been, you know, as soon as I started doing that, it opened up a lot of doors. And, you know, part of me is like, why didn't I do it sooner? But maybe I wasn't ready to do it sooner. And it's, you know, even with all these years of experience, I still deal with that inner fear, you know, of, you know, I'm showing a little bit of myself that maybe I'm not totally comfortable with. And it's a constant battle, you know, certain things get easier as you grow older and more experienced in your life. But as an artist, I think you always deal with that element of, oh, maybe somebody will find out that I'm not really an artist. Or, you know, you have that inner feeling of the artist syndrome, you know, and it's so common to everyone that I know that who's a creative.
Well, yes. imposter syndrome.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. That's it.
Right. You feel... Yeah, that's a very common thing, especially in creatives or especially in good creatives, right? Because there are people that are not so good.
Yeah, who have no problems.
No problem, yeah. And you're like, you're a really good talker and not necessarily a great artist.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Because I like,
It's definitely a challenge, but it's, you know, it's a beautiful challenge to accept. Sure. And it's something that as an artist... I think it's one of the most important things to be able to deal with, you know?
Absolutely.
But it's been a fun journey.
Yeah. Well, we are well over an hour.
Oh my God. Yeah.
It went fast.
I could definitely talk for a lot longer.
Yeah. Well, you can now that you're in LA, you're always welcome back. But it was a really great, journey that you took us through. And I really appreciate, you doing that, Afonso. So
thank you.
it's really cool. Definitely stay in touch. Let me know what things are going on. Let's get together more often. I mean, you're working in Burbank. I live in Burbank, so we're kind of going in opposite directions. But we can definitely just hang out. You know, you can reconnect me with Estrus. I didn't know he was in LA, which is amazing. So I want to talk to him. But yeah, let's all just hang out, dude. This is awesome. Yeah,
let's create things.
Let's make things. You know? Yeah.
That's cool. The goal.
Yeah. All right, man.
Thank you.